Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ, first of all this morning, to 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 12, and then Matthew 18. The trip to Alabama was good. We found Virginia on Thursday. I took her to the doctor in Montgomery. She was released from treatment from the lung doctor. And her rehab on her hand is progressing nicely. So things should return to normal for her as best as that's possible by sometime next month. So I'm grateful for your prayers and your support during this time. I want to go to our final verse of the paragraph we're noting regarding strong delusion. 2 Thessalonians 2:12 is the passage. And it is in this passage that several things are going to be noted. We're going to note the delusion, of course. And we're going to note a target of that delusion that is very important with regard to our ongoing study. 2 Thessalonians 2:12, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. And the phrase that we're emphasizing here is having not believed the truth. What a person believes is a matter of his own volitional choice. The issue in the angelic conflict is your free will. What you do with it is the issue, and it is free to make decisions. It is free to make choices, and it is free to motivate action. You, therefore, are held responsible for what you think, what you decide, and what you do before the justice of God. You're free to do what you want to do, but if it doesn't line up with the plan of God, you are held accountable for it. If it does line up with the plan of God, you will be rewarded for it. It is a very simple equation. No one can force you to do any of it because the whole issue is individual choice. You, therefore, are bound by the freedom you possess to use the assets that you have in order to worship God, serve God, and execute His plan. And therefore, He is the authority of the universe. He is the one who is in control of all things. He is the ultimate evaluator of all things. And therefore, humility is required for us to orient and adjust to this system. Now, some do not want to adjust, and that is okay. That's their free will. It's okay with me, I mean. And it's really okay with God, because God simply has allowed people to make choices, and He's willing to bless those who follow His leadership, and He will punish those who do not. The punishment comes in eternal condemnation for those who do not believe in Christ, and it comes in the form of divine discipline for those who do. So if a person changes his beliefs, it is because he has decided to do so. A change of one's beliefs is the result of an alteration of thought due to the inculcation of new information into the mentality of the soul. You do not alter your opinions, your attitudes, your dispositions, your belief system, unless you encounter information to change your present inventory of thought. And with that inculcation of new thought, you have the opportunity to make changes for the better or for the worse, as the case might be. Propaganda today is designed to deconstruct traditionalist thought in the souls of those who have it and to replace it with progressive ideology, which does not find itself bound by too many absolutes. The only absolute that they possess and hold is that there are no absolutes. Sounds ridiculous, because that is an absolute statement. But that is the only absolute statement that they go by. There are no absolutes. You make it up as you go along. Now, this is where the scrum of the invisible war occurs. It has to do with free will. Truth is communicated by grace and is accepted by faith. Truth is communicated by grace and it is accepted by faith. there's a problem today in that everyone insists that truth must be verified by experiment. That's empiricism. It has to be validated by experiment. And if it cannot be proved beyond a shadow of a doubt, then it is not necessarily true. There's also rationalism, which says if it doesn't make sense to me, it is not true. So something can be proved in the laboratory, but not accepted by the rationalist and therefore rejected as truth. And there can be a truth that is arrived at, allegedly, by the rationalists that the empiricist would contend has not been confirmed in the laboratory, therefore it is not true. But both of these systems rely on faith in order to get their initial basic conclusions. And as they arrive at these concepts, they then build upon them and move forward. All laws emerge from a thesis from a hypothesis. And as you move through the evaluation of the incoming data, you determine whether or not that information validates the premise. And then you move from there. And there's another way to learn, and that's to have confidence in the source of the information. And children have great confidence in adults to tell them the truth. You can tell a child when the sun comes up, "Fred, see the sun coming up over the horizon?" "Yes, Daddy." "That sun always rises every day in the west." And he will say, "Okay, I believe that." And he will go until someone tells him differently, believing the sun rises in the west. And he will enter into arguments about this. If someone says it rises in the east, he will take up the argument. "Oh no, it rises in the west. How do you know?" "My father told me it rises in the west." "Well, that's wrong. It rises in the east." "Oh no, I trust my father. He would tell me the truth." And then at some point he's going to learn that the sun rises in the east. But then, who cares? When you get out into space, what's north, south, east, and west anyhow? Is it to the left? Does it rise to the left? Or does it rise to the right? It depends on which direction you're facing. Is that up or down? Who knows? Are we actually upside down? There may be someday we can find these things out, but we orient to our environment and therefore we organize our environment and we establish principles based on that order and we move forward with it. But the debate about these things really is up in the air. What is truth? How do you find it? How can you have confidence in the things that you know? You must ultimately put faith in the source. And if you're an empiricist, you're ultimately going to put faith in the work of other men. They have done the work in the laboratory and you've decided to believe that. Or they have come to some conclusions from their brilliance and they've rationalized some axiom and contend that it is true. And if you buy it, it's because you put your faith in other men. Truth is communicated by grace and is accepted by faith. On the other hand, the lie is communicated by means of duplicity and deceit in the form of propaganda and is accepted as true. This is because of ignorance, negative volition, or a number of dispositions associated with the lust patterns of the soul. You really believe what you want to believe quite often because you have a lust to believe it. It contributes to your desires, to those things that emerge from the DNA of the body. And everybody has trends, and everyone has a certain lust pattern that dominates the others, and it's very hard to control. And if someone will give you a piece of information that justifies your behavior, you're ready to believe it, and you're ready to use that as a justification. Then you move forward with it. And it's very hard to change that. And when you tell an entire generation of children that certain things are really okay, and what your parents have told you is really passé, the children buy into it, they make decisions based upon that, and then their life's path has narrowed, future options have been narrowed, and their decisions have been narrowed. They've boxed themselves in because of propaganda. We have an entire educational system today that seems to be obsessed with communicating the lie. And I alert the parents to this. I'm not making this up. In fact, I was thinking about reading this particular email at the introduction to our prayer meeting. But I'll go ahead and read this one because it just crossed my mind based on something I just said. And this is from a Dorito. I get letters from Doritos. I get emails from them. But they go on and on about how wonderful things are here, and I'm just a little reticent to read that. But this I will read. It says, "Dear Pastor Griffin, my parents made me traditional. I went through a lot of Frankfurt College and graduate school, but emerged from a free market economics program as a pure capitalist, thank God. When I landed a faculty position at a university, I was immediately labeled as an extreme libertarian. The attitudes of the faculty were appalling to me, even without any doctrine. I was happy to marry and get gone after 18 months of that. So I can vouch for everything you say about the Frankfurt School from college days, from graduate school, then went on forever and forever, and then from being a fish on a faculty. The faculty part was the worst of all in retrospect because I could see what everyone was up to. Something was terribly wrong, but I couldn't quite put it all together. Now with the doctrine you have taught over the past few years, it all makes sense. And by the way, I survived a Catholic high school too, but that's another story. I now know how to think about that too." So we have living testimonials not only here in this room but elsewhere. And what they're testifying is that what I'm telling you about academia in general, from kindergarten to graduate school, is absolutely true, and the children have to be prepared for that. Now, it doesn't mean that your children can't go to public schools. That's not what I'm saying, for that is none of my business. Where you send your children to school is your business. All I'm trying to do is to keep you from being naive about it. Whenever they go to school, wherever they go to school, you're quite possibly this day and time sending them right into the heart of hell. And therefore you have to prepare them for this. What kind of disposition must a child have when they enter school if they are a traditionalist? Well, that's walking a tightrope. But one thing that they must understand is that the Lord says you cannot challenge duly appointed authority. And so you go in there and you learn the stuff. You learn it better than anybody there. Learn the lie. Repeat the lie back on the test. Make your grade and then forget everything you knew. Be a traditionalist. Be a fish in a progressive pond. And there are some core subjects in which it's very hard to lie. It's hard to lie about math. I learned that. I tried to juke my way through math, and you just can't do that. You can't juke your way through language. I learned that. Take language of every kind. English grammar. Take it. You think you know English grammar? You don't. If you cannot learn a foreign language unless you know English grammar. That was my problem in Spanish. I didn't know a participle from a verb. They may be the same thing for all I know. They threw words out like gerund. I have no idea what that is. I knew a guy named Jerry. I thought maybe it was what I know. And there are other subjects, though, that are very important that are distorted, deconstructed, like American history. You better know American history before you go into American history, because if you don't, you won't know American history when you come out, except from the distorted view. The first divine institution places accountability upon individual free will. The thoughts, decisions, and actions that result are either divine good or human good. the final accounting occurring at the evaluation tribunal of Christ. Only through spiritual growth and submission to biblical guidance will one's production be evaluated as gold, silver, or precious stones. Therefore, when a child moves into the arena of academia, he moves in to an environment that is designed to deconstruct traditionalist thought. Therefore, your children need to know traditionalist concepts going in, and you had better learn to monitor everything that goes on. You have a right to instruct your children in the truth. And when the lie is brought home, it must be pointed out. This is a lie. Of course, you would be more diplomatic than that. This is a lie. This is the truth. Now, tonight, we learn the lie. Because that is what they want you to know. And you will repeat this back. And you will make your grades. But this is the truth. This is what you must learn and keep in your soul. Repeating point two. Truth is communicated by grace and accepted by faith. On the other hand, the lie is communicated by means of duplicity and deceit in the form of propaganda and is accepted as true because of ignorance, negative volition, or a number of dispositions associated with the lust patterns of the soul. The lie can be accepted by one's faith in the source of the information. So the lie can be learned by faith as well. And the Lord addresses this problem in Jeremiah 17:5. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength and whose heart turns away from the Lord. Cursed if you trust in man. If what they tell you is true and it turns out to be a lie, it is your free will that bought it. And you're left accountable. Properly presented, children will learn the lie by placing their faith in false teachers. And the Lord addresses this problem in Matthew 18:6. But if anybody causes one of these little ones who believe in me to be offended, it would be more advantageous for him to have a huge millstone around his neck and to be drowned in the deepest part of the sea. This is called Operation Millstone. We've referred to it in the past, and now we will address it to some degree of brevity. And this is where we resume our study at point five. The interpretation of the passage in which this verse is found should send shockwaves through our population. There is an obvious problem with physical abuse of children, but there is an even more widespread assault upon the souls that appears to be benign, but in an insidious attempt at medicide. People can smile at children, use dulcet tones, and sell the lie. A child will believe what adults tell him. And this is being capitalized upon. The Catholic Church has made an accurate statement. I've heard it from you, so many of you. Give us a child in his youth and he will be a Catholic forever. What do they mean by that? We will propagandize. The Catholics use the word propaganda in a proper sense. In other words, in a positive sense. Propaganda means to convey information to others with the hopes that they will accept it as the truth. And you have catechisms and you go to Catholic schools and all of this, and they bombard you with this information, the dogma of the Church. And you're grilled in this. You have to repeat it back in the verbals as well as the writtens. And then ultimately you've got it and that's the way you think and you're locked into that. And the only way that that will ever change is if you accept other alternate thoughts into your inventory of ideas and consider them objectively. As many of you have done and have decided that what you learned is the lie, and therefore you're freeing yourself from it by coming to the Word of God. Now that's propagandizing. It works. The communists understood this because it was their idea to get the children into some state-run school as quickly as possible, to allow them to go home to their parents on the weekends only, but 5 days out of the week they were propagandized into the thought process of communism. so that when they became adults, they were full-fledged communists submitting to the entire state. So that's the idea. So there's an obvious problem with physical abuse of children, but there's an even more widespread assault upon the souls that appears to be benign, but is an insidious attempt at menticide. Now, point six. The education of a child should have as its primary focus the communication of truth, eloquently expressed by Dr. Russell Kirk in his book, published in 1978. Please note the copyright date. The title of his book is Decadence and Renewal in the Higher Learning. And it's subtitled An Episodic History of American University and College Since 1953. Now, I like what he has to say here, but I also want you to see the context of when he wrote it. 1978 is when he copyrighted this book, but he's going to take academia from 1953 and speak of its decadence. This is over 50 years ago. Well, let's see what he has to say. The academy, if it is to enjoy rights, must acknowledge some principles of truth and not constitute itself as a mere sophistical debating society, doubting everything, sneering at all old convictions. See, that's a description of progressivism, sneering at traditionalism. The academy sins if the academy places falsehood on the same platform with truth. The academy sins. Why? The conveyance of the lie is an evil, and it will be pointed out in Matthew 18. It is an evil that puts the Millstone Production Committee on overtime. The academy sins if the academy places falsehood on the same platform with truth. And when college or university offers instruction in a subject, this implies that some truth may be found in the discipline. That is not true today. They don't go by that because what is truth? We don't know what truth is because we can't evaluate it in the laboratory and nail it down. Or our philosophers can't nail it down in their philosophies. What is truth? They have set themselves up to where if we can't have omniscience and know all of the details about every issue, and if truth can't be absolutely nailed down as if we had omniscience, then we must contend that there is no truth. God has omniscience. He has nailed the truth and revealed most of it to us in writing, and we must have faith in the source. We trust God to tell us the truth. We do not need experiment. We do not need rationalism. We accept it on faith. God knows what He's talking about, and He wants us to know it, and we don't need proof. And we're going to... I apologize to you. We've gotten in a passage here, and we're going to be here a while. Here we go again. But I've gotten information you need to know. That's just the way this goes. Now let's give an example here of the points we've just made from Dr. Kirk's book. Here is a newspaper headline. Pennsylvania School Board at the Center of Evolution Debate. The story concerned the town of Dover, Pennsylvania, which was sued by the ACLU in federal court at the end of last year over its incorporation of, quote, intelligent design arguments in the public school biology curriculum. Now, if you're not familiar with intelligent design, it is simply a code word for God did it. And you get around all of these wacky rules about you can't mention God anywhere except in Sunday school, and you certainly better be careful about that. But if you do mention God, let it be that place only. And you do not bring Him up in a schoolroom. Horrors. So how do you get around the biology deal that says that we evolved from an amoeba? I mean, do you know what evolution teaches? I decided to let you know today, for those of you who actually may have taken your free will and placed your faith in what is being communicated in that arena. I have a book. And in this book, there's an appendix. And the appendix tells us the seven main postulates of the theory of evolution. I almost said theology because it's really a religion. The theology of evolution. Here are the seven main postulates. You know, note what a postulate is. We assert the following to be true, but we don't know yet. Number one, non-living matter spontaneously produced living matter at biogenesis. In other words, living matter emerged from non-living matter. How did that happen? Point two. Spontaneous biogenesis, according to number one, only occurred once, so that all present-day life descended from one single primeval cell. Now, this is where we go to this whole deal, where this is the vast oceans and this is the shore. And out here in the vast ocean, something happened. And number one took place. And it's just one little gizmo out there in all of the oceans. One little throbbing gizmo. Got it? In all of the oceans. Spontaneous biogenesis, according to number one, only occurred once so that all present-day life descended from one single primeval cell. This assumption is supposedly supported by the fact that the genetic code is identical in all known forms of life, both plant and animal. Only the information writing the code varies from species to species. The identical, highly complex code of life is unlikely to have developed by chance at different times under different conditions to produce separate microspheres with identical codes. For this reason, it is assumed that this chance biogenesis, which supposedly ended in the formation of the genetic code, took place only once. Number three, the different viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are all descended from one another. They are all interrelated phylogenetically. Your grandmother was a radish. Number four, metazoa, that's multicelled organisms, developed spontaneously without plan out of protozoa, single-celled organisms, according to the principles of chance, mutation, and natural selection. Number five, the vertebrates are all phylogenetically interrelated. Number six, the vertebrates are phylogenetically related to the invertebrates. And number seven, all vertebrates are phylogenetically interrelated. What do you think? You gonna buy that? You believe that? Anybody? I'm willing to see hands. Now let's talk about faith. You believe that? You have to have some faith, people. There's no proof of this in anybody's laboratory. If we all started out as one little one-celled gizmo that suddenly zapped itself out of nothing, out of rock, into sudden life, and then everything emerged from that, everything, plant, animal, you name it, then I contend there were no witnesses. Therefore, you can go through all of your experiments, anything you want to come up with, you can read your rocks, and you can go back and decide that this is how it occurred. But if you tell it to someone, they have to believe it on faith. Don't you agree? There's no laboratory experiment. There are no witnesses. There's no film at 11. There's nothing on which you can contend that this is true except by faith. Thus, evolution is a theology. Now, what about natural selection, those things we've just read? Natural selection requires the prior existence of self-replicating DNA molecules before it can work. The pre-existence, the prior existence of self-replicating DNA molecules before it can work. But the question arises, what is the source of DNA to begin with? That's a legitimate question. What's the source? Now, I have a suggestion on the source, but you would have to accept it on faith. Let's go back to the Pennsylvania school. What if a professor started teaching intelligent design? He would be ordered to stop. And the question arises is why? Because it can't be tested experimentally. But the same can be said for the theology of evolution. Question arises, should either be taught in the schools? If the cosmologists don't know, we can't prove it. We accept it on faith. So do they. Should either be taught? And the answer could be, well, yes and no. Either both are taught or both are ignored. But if one is taught, it must be presented honestly. Children, this is what we think might have happened under certain circumstances, way back in the far distant past, maybe. Here we go. And teach that. For I would assert that the academy sins if the academy places falsehood on the same platform as truth. And when college or university offers instruction in a subject, this implies that some truth may be found in the discipline. If the rising generation, now get this is where you get humility as far as a student is concerned. When a student enrolls in a class, he is there without portfolio. If you knew the subject, why enroll in the course? There are many students who enroll in a course and they think they know as much, if not more, than the professor. Have you ever been in those classes? And you think, I would think, why are you even here? If you know all of this stuff and you're willing to challenge the professor on all of this, why are you here if you know so much? Why are you not teaching? Why are you not at the stupid center over there drinking something? That's what I would have done. If the rising generation already could perceive every difference between truth and falsehood, the rising generation would not need to enter the academy at all. And there's the challenge for parents. Children cannot distinguish between all truth and all falsehood. They are students. Therefore, they're the ones who receive the instruction because they do not yet have the inventory to discern these things. And if what they're taught further clouds the issue, then a red light goes on and the Millstone Production Center. This is a time which communism was one of the more prominent pieces of propaganda, and so he addresses that by treating communism or some other fanatic ideology as entitled to have its ferocious say. The academy would give political madness implicit sanction, and it's going on daily in our universities. Many aspects of the sound and fury about academic freedom in 1954 were disheartening. But the most saddening was the spectacle of certain professors with tenure, good salaries, and all the benefits of constitutional order, implying that communism was quite as worthwhile as any other form of social organization. Let us not discriminate against the votaries of Lenin and Stalin. Let's not be beastly to the Hun. That is what Burke called licentious toleration. And we are eat up with licentious toleration today. You come up with some oddball, wacko, deviant idea and you're supposed to be tolerated. And if I don't tolerate your wacko, deviant idea, I'm said to be mean-spirited. If I say you're wrong, I'm being judgmental. If I say it's sin, well then, they blow their stack at that point. There is no sin. There's no sin. The only sin is you telling me I'm sinning. That's a sin. Licentious toleration. Memorize that. When someone says you're being judgmental, when you have to be tolerant, you tell them, you are asking me to approve of you licentiously. And that would be licentious toleration, evil. The objects of a decent society have been known for a great while, within and without the academy. These objects are order, justice, and freedom. But the persons whom Sidney Hook called ritualistic liberals had dropped those objects and so were decadent and involved the academy in their decay of reason. The decay of reason is where you find the academy today. Point 7. Now, 50 years later, this decay of reason has crept from the university schools of education all the way down to the kindergarten classrooms of America. In those 50 years, the venom, the lie, the duplicity, the propaganda, the ball of yarn has unstrung all the way from the schools of education down to the kindergarten classroom. And this is designed to alert parents so that they're not naive about what is going on. But you must use your doctrine. The issue is the soul of your child. That's the issue. But you must protect your child's soul within the parameters of the authority systems that have been set up. There are ways to manage these things without demonstrating, without calling names, without pitching fits and swapping slobber. There are systems that God has provided for you to manage these affairs. And your major motivation is what is right for your child right now. Make it all about your child and your protection of him. Do not talk about other people's children and they shouldn't be taught this, that, or the other. That's their parents' job to decide. This is not right for my child at this time. It's just not right. And see how it goes. But the main thing to know is that you have to be on the alert. And about that subject, we will proceed at about 10 till the hour as we resume our study at that time.